the two backbones we are dealing with, and they, of course, are the primary structure that helps us understand how we get this amphoteric molecule that's both nonpolar on, with the tails and the polar on the head groups and so on. We're looking at overhead number 17 near the end of this chapter, and then we are going to, and we're actually going to be focusing on the last part of chapter 17, of overhead number 17. This is how do membrane-bound proteins get inserted into the membrane? That's the question. We know that there are proteins that penetrate and exist in the membrane permanently. Well, as permanent as any protein is. Of course, there's always constant recycling, but its place of residence, where it's active and where its purpose is in the membrane. How does it get there? What do we know how it gets there? Well, this is a process that was discovered laboriously over many years. This is the bottom of overhead number 17. And it deals with how ribosomes, a protein called a translocon, and a signal peptide on the newly forming protein all work together to insert a protein into a membrane. Now, typically, let's see what membrane are we talking about. You can see this as I'm circling near the upper left-hand part of this graphic, the rough endoplasmic reticulum. That's where proteins that are destined to be embedded in membranes are inserted. Rough endoplasmic membrane is called rough because of the ribosomes that are attached to it. Not permanently necessarily, but there's a continuous existence, presence of ribosomes on the surface of this bilayer. So as we move around counterclockwise from the label that says endoplasmic reticulum, we see that we find two proteins that are known to exist in the rough ER, a protein type called translocon, and another type of protein called SRP receptor. SRP receptor. And that is, the SRP stands for, anybody remember what SRP stands for? This is called the signal recognition protein. Signal recognition proteins, SRP. So this is a signal recognition protein receptor. Immediately below that that label is something that says SRP-GDP. SRP-GDP. That is, in fact, a signal recognition protein. It has temporarily a small molecule called GDP attached to it. It's waiting there for the next thing as we go counterclockwise around this figure. You see the beginning of a fairly complicated snake-like or rope-like situation going on here, or graphic. You see something called, that's labeled as messenger RNA, starting at the 5 prime. You see a ribosome with its two subunits. And you see something emerging from the ribosome called the signal peptide. So what's actually beginning to form here is you have the messenger RNA that's actually has a ribosome producing a protein. And that protein, as it emerges from the ribosome, has a unique series of amino acids in a particular order, and that becomes the signal peptide. And that signal peptide is recognized by that signal recognition protein and binds to it. And notice, if you would, as it binds to it, the GDP is lost and a GTP is bound. That's a subtle indication that you have now an active process of producing a signal recognition protein. That signal recognition protein then says, hey, this protein is designed to be embedded in a membrane. And so the GTP bound to the signal recognition protein and the SRP then combine to guide that protein into the translocon. In the meantime, while it finds that translocon, as you follow the numbered actions, number one there at the very bottom left-hand side of the figure is this polypeptide synthesis begins. Then number two, the next part of the sequence is, after that SRP binds to it, the peptide synthesis is inhibited until it finds that signal recognition protein and binds to it. Once the SRP docks to the receptor to form that ribosome translocon complex, then the signal recognition protein is fed into that translocon pore. It's a pore that exists. At that point, the SRP and the SRP receptor dissociate, and that signals the ribosome to begin producing the peptide of interest, and it passes through the translocon, and you begin to build this protein within the interior lumen of the ER. That signal recognition, the signal peptide is removed partway through this process, and you have this fully formed protein being produced. It begins to form and fold into its appropriate structure. Carbohydrates are added to it. Eventually, it's removed from the translocon and then embedded permanently in the lipid bilayer of this endoplasmic reticulum. The ribosome dissociates, the messenger RNA dissociates, and either can it gets repeated if it's needed or degraded if it's needed, depending on the needs of the cell. Ultimately, at the end, you find you have this fully formed protein embedded through a membrane, and it has carbohydrates on, what are they called, peppered throughout the structure as appropriate. As added to it, of course, you will note eventually that as the interior of the rough endoplasmic reticulum blebs off into vesicles or gets transformed into Golgi apparatus and moves toward the surface, that the interior lumen of the rough endoplasmic reticulum and other endoplasmic reticulums eventually become the exterior, exposed to the exterior. So while this is in the interior, the cell, as that merges with the surface of the cell, this will eventually be exposed to the exterior, and that's why that's carbohydrated. That's why it's a glycoprotein. So I would recommend that you look at the caption for this particular diagram. This is, to me, a very important one. There's a good chance, although not guaranteed, that I would ask a question about this. You will not have to regurgitate this diagram in toto, but you may ask, I may make some mistakes in it, I may ask you to outline it, tell me the order of what's happening. I may actually, one question is I may remove these labels and ask you to label it appropriately in order, just for you to be reminded of how this works. How do you insert, and the question this answers is, how do you insert a protein that's bound and destined to remain in the protein? How do you get it? Bound and destined to remain in a membrane. How do you get it into the membrane so that it's there appropriately? And this is how that process occurs. It's a part of the secretory pathway because eventually this is exposed to the exterior. Let's go on to the next thing. Now, this question that this particular chapter, overhead number 19, asks is how do things that are made in the endoplasmic reticulum and are in the interior of the endoplasmic reticulum, how do they get to the surface? Well, this is actually much more of a cell biology question than it is a biochemistry question. But biochemists have to deal with cell biology at this level because it helps us understand the nature of the proteins and why they are the way they are. So this question that's being asked on this particular slide is, how do proteins formed in the rough ER get to the surface? And so here's the process whereby they get to the surface. As you see here, you see the nucleus, you see the at the top of the diagram, you see the rough ER and the ER. You see an organelle called the Golgi apparatus, and then you see a variety of secretory vesicles that have bled off from the Golgi apparatus and move toward the surface. So what happens is, of course, these proteins, which are we just saw on the previous slide, are synthesized and embedded in the membrane of the rough ER, move to the Golgi apparatus where they are processed. Those carbohydrate pieces that you saw in peppering the surface or of the protein are not fixed. They're constantly being altered by a wide variety of proteins that are in the rough ER and also in the Golgi apparatus. And as those carbohydrates on the surface or on the peppering the exterior of that protein are modified, it gives the cell a signal to where their ultimate fate is supposed to be. So the rough ER then moves those proteins to the Golgi apparatus. As an aside, this is essentially what I did for my doctoral work at Purdue University. I was working with a professor, D.J. Murray, and his work, his claim to fame was he was an outstanding electron microscopist, and he worked a lot with the nature and purpose and function of the Golgi apparatus. And so one of the interesting fights that was going on, and it's still not resolved within the scientific community that dealt at this level of cell biology, is what is the nature of the Golgi apparatus? And how does it, in fact, move materials from the early part of its, from early part, in other words, from where the materials are accepted from the Golgi apparatus in the cisternae, to the transcisternae and to the trans-Golgi network, how are they moved? And so Dr. Murray was of the camp that believed that the Golgi apparatus, because it's stacked like this, like a stack of pancakes, is that the cisternae are formed from membrane blebbed, that's an interesting word, isn't it? Blebbed from vesicles from the rough ER, where they form this cisternae, and the cisternae physically move and are matured, in other words, they change the nature of the enzymes within the cisternae, move from cis to medial to trans, and eventually bleb off, break down into the Golgi, into these secretory vesicles, and move toward the surface. Others believed that the cisternae, the medial cisternae, and transcisternae were fixed, and that the blebbing occurred at the edges of the Golgi apparatus, and those vesicles moved from location from cis to medial to trans, and that's how the proteins were transformed or moved through the Golgi apparatus, because they knew they were moving through the Golgi apparatus. When you look at the physical and chemical characteristics of the cis versus trans Golgi apparatus, it's an amazing transformation that's occurring. That when you look at the enzymes, the pH, the nature of the phospholipids for the cisternae, they're very similar to the pH, the enzyme characteristics, and the membrane components of the rough ER. Whereas you would look at the trans Golgi, the trans Golgi cisternae, their pH, their membrane composition, their enzymes are very similar to the plasma membrane. So the Golgi apparatus has a function in maturing the membrane and the contents of the vesicles, maturing them, as it were, from their existence in the rough ER and to their existence in just prior to their binding and blebbing and merging with the plasma membrane. So the models are, there's a couple words here, anterograde and retrograde. Anterograde is that the proteins are moved forward from the interior, that's the rough ER, in a continuous motion toward the surface, and retrograde, that they move backwards. And there is some evidence that the retrograde movement does occur, that this arrow that you see, this double-headed arrow moving forward and backward, does occur. And they're still not sure exactly what it all means, though. The models are, A, the first model I talked about was the model that Dr. Murray agreed with, which had his cisternary maturation, where the cis matures into the medial and matures then in the transcisternary, and then the transcisternary simply break down, forms these vesicles in the trans-Golgi network, and then move to the surface. And others, a guy named Rothman, I remember as a name, believed that the proteins were shuttled by vesicles being bled off from the edges of the Golgi apparatus. They're still fighting over it. They still don't know, despite years of investigation. And it ebbs and flows in the explanation. But these vesicles that you find right here, the secretory vesicles and some other vesicles that you find in near the surface of the plasma membrane, have a very important biochemistry and biochemicals with them, although it's still a cell biology question. So the question that this next segment down here in the bottom of overhead number 18, is asking is, how are these vesicles formed from the membrane? How can you form vesicles from membrane? What is the mechanical part of making a vesicle out of a membrane? So if you could imagine, as you know, this wall, you are now microscopic. You've just been shrunk and injected into a cell, and you're now floating here as a sentient being, and you come across this structure right here, and this turns out to be the wall of a rough endoplasmic reticulum. This entire wall is rough endoplasmic reticulum membrane. Your job is to pull on this rubber, like a rubber, you know, a balloon, you know, the surface. Pull on this tight rubber sheet here, elastic sheet, and make a vesicle out of it. How would you do that? How did nature solve the problem of trying to make a vesicle out of something that appears to be a sheet of paper, essentially? Well, this is where this material comes in. This is called clathrin. Have you heard of clathrin before? Yeah. You have. Some have, some haven't. This clathrin is a protein that exists as, and get this, you probably have, some of you have never heard of this term before, a triskelion. A triskelion. And I don't even try, just like triskeleton, except don't put a ton at the end, put an IO. You and triskelion, whatever. This is a triskelion right here, and it uses up ATP. This triskelion, however, appears to be flat, but a triskelion actually is like a bit of a tripod. It actually, its three-dimensional structure is not flat, but is like this. And it's like almost like a jacks, as it were. But it's just three legs pointing out at an angle like this. Now, what happens is that if I may become a triskelion, that it means that my legs are one arm, and my other arm is the other arm, and the third arm is like this. And so I'm not flat, I'm angled like this. Okay, and so, would you mind getting up? If you don't mind. Thank you so much. So, what happens is, would you mind making a triskelion? What I mean, I need for you to do something like this. Okay, now I need for you not to be flat, you know, like this. Okay, so notice she is sort of like this. Oh, we don't need to be, anyway, it doesn't matter. Anyway, so we're like this. What happens is that she's curved like this. I'm essentially curved like this. What happens is we begin to build like this. And notice, just like a geodesic dome, as we begin to build, if I get enough of you around here, I can make a sphere, couldn't I? Did you lower your arm? Okay. Anyway, as we associate each other, you know, we're like this, but as we associate and like this, we can eventually form a spheroid. And if, in fact, pardon me, I'm going to catch you over here. If you're attached like this, and I'm attached like this, we could pull out, as we form this spheroid, we could attach to something on the membrane here and to literally begin to pull out part of this rubber form and start to make a bleb. Does that make sense? You may sit down. Thank you so much. You're very kind for allowing me to embarrass you like that. That as these triskelions associate with each other and associate with the membrane, they begin to pull on the membrane and actually begin to pull it out like a bleb. Just like if someone came along and began to pull on my shirt, pull in on here, and then pull it here, and pull it here. Eventually, from this flat surface, I could make a ball. And you can see here, this is exactly what happens. That as these triskelions interact, they can form this spheroid surface. If they form that spheroid surface with membrane trapped in between, that you can then pull off little blebs from the Golgi apparatus and from the rough ER to make these secretory vesicles. So the clathrin-coated vesicle, notice what I say, clathrin-coated vesicle, is a very common thing that you find associated with the edges of the Golgi apparatus and near the surface of the plasma membrane. Since they've discovered the clathrin-coated vesicles, they've also found other coating proteins that do the same thing called COP1 and COP2. These are called coatomers, coat proteins. That's why they're called COP. Coat protein 1, coat protein 2. And they all basically have the same idea that because of their unique structure, they help in the acidity, they provide the power and the structure necessary to make a vesicle out of a flat sheet of membrane. All right. Once you have that vesicle formed, what happens to it? What is its fate? So this is the last overhead in chapter 9. And this is really just a very, 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 very quick overview of how proteins are assisting in the fusion of vesicles to the target membrane. So if this is answering a question, if overhead number 19 is answering a question, the question would be, once the vesicles are formed, how do they fuse to the target membrane, and what proteins are known to assist in that fusion? How do they fuse, and what membranes are known to assist in that fusion? Well, of course, if you have two membrane-bound items approaching each other, there is this. The model that we're using to assist this in understanding this, of course, is happening at the presynaptic or postsynaptic, at the synaptic vesicle, at the synaptic cleft, where the nerve endings release, or I have that, where they release neurotransmitters into this synaptic cleft. This is the classic model they use for membrane fusion because it can occur readily and on command, and they can study it pretty well. So the model we're using to understand membrane fusion comes from synaptic clefts. So we're going to be using some of the terminology of synaptic clefts. So we're going to assume that membrane fusion occurs at synapses, which we know. There's a presynaptic membrane, which encapsulates the synaptic vesicles, and then the postsynaptic membrane. Then, of course, you have the synaptic cleft that is between the two. So the top right-hand figure on overhead number 19 illustrates the synaptic vesicle, the presynaptic membrane, the synaptic cleft, and the postsynaptic membrane. We're going to focus primarily on the synaptic vesicles fusing with the presynaptic membrane. So as it says here, fusion requires intervention by proteins. Proteins are crucial in the fusion of those two membrane types because the polar head groups of both of these membranes are water-loving. There's not going to be an automatic attraction between the two. There's a lot of water in between, and that would prevent them from being attracted to each other. So proteins are required to bring them close enough to fuse. So the membrane types are names are kind of cutesy ones that membrane scientists came up with. They're called snares. Snares. Now, the snares, I think, have some. It's an abbreviation for something. I've forgotten what it is. Some kind of funky-dunky name. But they're called snares. And there is a snare called R snare and a Q snare. That is a snare on the R snare is the postsynaptic target, and the Q snares, SNAP to Brevin and SNAP 25, are on the target membrane. So that there's snares on the vesicle, snares on the target membrane. And what happens is, and there are different snares. One is called syntaxin. Another is called SNAP to Brevin and SNAP 25. The Q snare is actually on the target membrane, and the R snare is on the vesicle. And so the model is that these two different types of snares actually begin to approach each other and begin to intertwine. As they intertwine, they force the two membrane types up to approach each other and assist in the fusion of that membrane. And as the two leaflets interact, they then begin to refuse into the membrane itself, and then the contents are dumped into the synaptic cleft. And you can see here, there's a wide variety of proteins that are occurring at that intertwining. There's some regulatory proteins, some mechanical force proteins. All these different types of proteins are interacting at that interwinding spot. At any rate, so what do I need to know out of this, from this question? The process of creating a fusion of the membranes between the vesicle and the target membrane is nice to know. So I would understand this process. Are you going to have to regurgitate it? No. I may again do similarly what I'm going to do with the signal recognition protein process. I may block these out and ask you to put them in order, these comments in this particular diagram. And then just know the difference between presynaptic and postsynaptic membranes and what an R snare is, which is syntaxin, and a Q snare, which is SNAP to Brevin and SNAP 25. That's all I need for you to know out of that. Okay? All right. So that's the end of chapter 9. We're now going to go on to chapter 10. Chapter 10 is, the last one I have uploaded. I'm going to have to upload the other one here pretty soon, aren't I? So I'm going to close that, and here's chapter 10. Now, chapter 10 is relatively straightforward. It actually only has a few slides in it, 8 actually. So it's pretty handy, and it's pretty much of a eclectic kind of mix, as it were. An eclectic kind of mix. Now, we're still talking. Now we're now are dealing with chapter 10, which is called membrane transport. And that's not how membranes are transported. The question that's answering is, how are materials transported through the membranes? Because many of the membranes are impermeable to proteins and ions, so on. So let's fill in this overhead that's listed here. The first blank is just called concentration. The second blank has got a name called ion. Next blank is called electrochemical. So the first three blanks are concentration, ion, and electrochemical. The last four blanks are mediated, passive. Next blank, third blank, from the second blank to the bottom is active. And the last blank on the overhead is called fusion. Fusion. So what question is this first slide answering? Well, the first question, there are two questions this first slide is answering. The first question is, what is the driving force that moves things across a membrane? They do not do this spontaneously. Well, they do, but only if there is a driving force. What is the driving force and how can we mathematically understand it? And the second question is, comes at the bottom. Are there some definitions we need to know about the kinds of transports that are going on? So let's look at the energy. What is the driving force behind this? Well, the driving force, or something I call here, is free energy. The first and simplest is simply a concentration gradient. And that is that materials will move from a high concentration to a low concentration. Physical chemists would say it would move from a high activity to a low activity. This is, after years of working in chemistry and biology, this is simple common sense. We can give this a mathematical value by using the equation that's shown here. The free energy of movement of the compound A is equal to RTLN, the natural logarithm of the concentration of A. And if we, that's the gross equation. The net equation is we look at the free energy of the concentration of A inside minus outside, and we get a little more complicated equation. Simply says the change in the free energy or the activity from outside versus inside is simply RTLN, the concentration in divided by the concentration out. And so having having a difference in the concentrations between the inside and the out simply provides that motive force, that free energy necessary to drive materials across the membrane. Now, are there other forces involved with that? Yes, absolutely. The next kind of force is literally a voltage force. It's due to the fact that you have many ions both inside and outside your cell. So ion charge can produce an electrical gradient, which produces a membrane potential, which then helps drive the ion across the membrane. That electrical gradient is given the Greek symbol psi, and so it's psi in minus psi out. And in a very similar way, you have a volt that is literally listed in volts or millivolts. So you have the change in voltage is the voltage out, voltage in minus the voltage out. So you get this change in voltage that occurs across a membrane. As it turns out, after much study, it was discovered that the driving force that enabled proteins and other ions to move across a membrane was a composition of both forces, the membrane concentration, the concentration gradient, and a voltage gradient. And that was combined into a single law, into a single mathematical equation that is called the electrochemical gradient. And so it takes into account just the raw concentration of the material plus its voltage, which is plus its free energy due to the voltage. That's the charge, that's the Faraday constant, that's a change in voltage. So this is called an electrochemical gradient. You can have a wide variety of values for both just the concentration and the voltage. So the electrochemical gradient is composed of two factors: the difference in the concentration of the materials and the difference in the voltage due to those materials. That is what causes the impetus of the driving force in moving one material from one side of the gradient to the next. All right. That's the first explanation. The second question is, what are some simple definitions that we need to know about transport? Well, down here at the bottom of this, of course, there's transport is basically defined as mediated and non-mediated. Either you get help or you don't get help. The non-mediated is really very simple. Non-mediated is simply diffusion across the membrane. There's no protein or a pore assist. There's no protein there. It's simply moving across through the lipid bilayer based on its electrochemical gradient. That occurs pretty rarely. There's only a few molecules that can do that without assisting. Those are primarily highly nonpolar compounds that are highly dissolved in gas, in water. For example, oxygen and carbon dioxide move freely through a membrane without any kind of transport assist. So diffusion in gases is very common. Mediated is much more common. Typically, there's a protein involved. that protein, so if you have a protein involved, you're dealing with mediated. If the protein does not use any energy, that's called passive mediated transport. Passive mediated transport. If you have energy involved, if energy is required to help move that material across the membrane, you have active mediated transport. All right. Oop. So, look at that. Just a blank. Now, differentiate it between mediated and non-mediated. Mediated transport has the following. Okay. Let's take a look. So, hopefully, we'll fill this in here right live today. So, speed and specificity. So here's the speed and specificity. Speed and specificity. All right, so for example, what is one of these? Glucose 6-phosphate concentration, methyl glucose 6-phosphate concentration. Okay? There's an enzyme. There is a transporter for glucose 6-phosphate. Okay? Glucose 6-phosphate. There's not a transporter for methylated glucose 6-phosphate. And so here you have, I'm going to call this A. I'm going to call this X. And I'm going to put the concentration of A down here. I'm going to put the concentration of X down here. Pardon me as I ignore that. Boom. And let me turn that down. I apologize. I keep forgetting to turn that down. Boom. Okay, so what happens is this. This over here, this is the rate. This is the rate right here. Rate. So, relative concentration of A, relative concentration of X. So, I'm going to draw A is going to be a solid line. So, it's going to be something that looks like this. And X is going to be dashed. Just dashed. Okay. So there's a lot of information in this diagram right here. A has a transporter. X does not. This is simple diffusion. There's no transporter for X. How can I tell that there is a transporter for A? Well, you can tell there's a transporter for A for two reasons. First reason is speed. It's a lot faster than simple diffusion. And two, a fancy word, saturatable. What does the term saturatable mean? Saturatable. It gets a certain concentration and you can't transport any faster. You get to a certain point and you cannot transport any faster. Why does this up here indicate that it's saturatable? Right, because if I added more A, am I going to get any faster rate of transport? No. So that means these two things especially means this is mediated. It's mediated because I can saturate the carrier. I can saturate the carrier. I can have so much of the transport material there that the carrier can't go any faster. So it's speed and saturatable. Is diffusion saturatable according to this model? No. All right. Well, at any rate, so speed and specificity. I guess I got ahead of myself, but that doesn't matter. Now, so notice here, if you would, it's specific. Notice methylglucose has this relatively low line. Glucose-6-phosphate has this very fast line. In other words, that the transporter will transport glucose-6-phosphate, but it will not transport methyl-glucose-6-phosphate. So it's very specific what mediated transporters will transport. They are very specific. Now, over here is this saturation. I guess I should write that in. It's simply, I'm going to repeat what I just did here. I've got A, and so I can do this again to the thing. Where you, again, you have a situation here where that material, if you get too much A, if A is the transporter, you can saturate the transporter. Competition. Let's see here. We're going to have here, this is again rate. And we're going to have A here. And then we're going to give that a straight line. And then we're going to have known as A plus Y, a known competitor. For that transporter. So A by itself, of course, the rate's going to have this. But if I add A, and this is going to be a dashed line. If I add a competitor that I know competes for that same binding site on the protein, I'm going to end up having a much lower rate. A much lower rate. It may even have the same kind of curve, but nevertheless, this Y is interfering with the A attaching to the protein. So it just slows it that way. So this is another way of knowing that you have a mediated transport. And lastly, inactivation. So the rate of movement versus temperature. For A. So you have some temperature that you've got a rate that it moves across the membrane. And what happens is, eventually, as the temperature rises, the rate drops. Why would the rate drop as the temperature rises? What's happening? Protein is unfolding and losing its ability to transport. So if you see any of these, diffusion would be what? Draw a line for diffusion, it'd be straight across. Maybe even a little higher as the temperature increases. So this is diffusion, or non-mediated transport, and it definitely has a different characteristic than does mediated. So all these different graphs tell us through data that we have mediated transport, differentiating mediated transport from diffusion. All right, what kind of mediated transport do we have? Well, the question this slide answers, overhead number four, is what kind of passive mediated transport is there? Now, passive mediated transport, does that mean we use energy or we don't use energy as with transports? Don't use energy. And so there's a couple different kinds. The first two blanks on this overhead is carrier and channel. The third blank is temperature. Fourth blank is fluidity. And the fifth blank is at the bottom called equilibrates. 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 All right. So passive mediated transport are embodied by materials called ionophores. There is just literally a pore or a hole for ions. There's two different kinds of ionophores. One's called a carrier, and which literally picks up an ion and physically moves it across the membrane. The other's called channel forming. It forms a little hole in the membrane and allows the ion to pass through. It's very simple to distinguish between the two. You can see here, there's the carrier, picks it up on one side, dumps it on another. The channel forming has a hole here, passes through, and ends up on the other side. This is exquisitely selective. It's amazing. It can allow a potassium but not a sodium through, or vice versa. You would think of it, once it gets to a certain size, anything smaller than that would just pass right on through. Nope. It can distinguish between smaller ions and larger ions. It's amazing. But at any rate, so which one of these two do you think would be more affected by the TM? Capital T, lowercase m. I'm going to ask you to remember just a few days ago, I said something about a TM. Capital T, lowercase m. Do you remember what that was talking about? Transition temperature, that's exactly right. For what transition, though? Liquid to solid, it's actually called the gel. Yeah. So you got the liquid crystal and then you got the gel. So below the TM temperature, both of these carriers work well. Above the TM temperature, pardon me, I scratched that. Above the TM temperature, both these carriers work well. However, as the fluidity of the membrane decreases, one of these channels begins to work less well. Which of these channels do you think works less well as the temperature drops? Yeah, what's it say here? The carrier type is altered by membrane fluidity changes in temperature. So the carrier type ionophore is hindered when the temperature drops below the TM. When the membrane becomes less fluid, it can't move rapidly between the two leaflets. The channel-forming ionophore doesn't have trouble with that because it doesn't require physical movement. It just is an open pore. It's not saying that the membrane fluidity doesn't affect it. It just doesn't affect it as much. So valomycin is a very common channel-forming ionophore. This is an antibiotic. Potassium fits well in the channel, but no other monovalent ion does. So it only equilibrates potassium ion concentrations, no selectivity of concentration, this kind of thing. Bacteria have a hard time dealing with the change in potassium ion concentration. So valomycin is used a lot to whack bacteria, as you know. Not so much in humans. I mean, it's not specific enough, and it makes people very sick because it also equilibrates to some degree, not as well, but some degree potassium. Note here, you don't have to read that section in that chapter 10. Okay, now then, the ion channel, I guess that's it. All right, so we're done for the day, and your tests are back, and you guys did pretty well, and I'll try to get a new schedule for you tomorrow. We haven't figured out exactly when we're doing the let's see here. The ion quizzes will be available not in class, but during the day on Thursday and Friday. Please plan on just coming in and doing them during your free time on Thursday and Friday. There's a reading guide. Chapter number 24 is due on Friday as well. Also, did you notice I changed the due dates for the sapling homework? It's now due when? Monday. Yeah, Monday. And you'll find that I specifically picked questions I knew that you could answer. I knew you could answer relatively straightforwardly. Thank you very much. We will see you on tomorrow.